Okay, our speaker this afternoon will be Theodore Edwards from Los Angeles. He's the Southern California chairman of the SWP. He is the a biweekly commentator on KPFK, the Pacifica station in Los Angeles, and he is a Marxist writer and lecturer. He will speak today on the internal situation in China today.
Now, if the history of the last 50 years has demonstrated anything, I think it has demonstrated that bureaucratism is one of the evils that every successful revolution must face, particularly in countries of low economic and cultural level, because there, widespread poverty and want tend to give the bureaucracy an inordinate role from the very first, and this in turn opens the door to special privileges, which that bureaucracy of the state apparatus then seeks to consolidate by excluding from participation in political life the working class and the insurgent masses. Now, the appreciation of this phenomenon began in the Russian Revolution with Lenin. It was developed further by Trotsky, especially in his fight against the Stalin clique. Now, the central contradiction that confronted the Soviet Union in Trotsky's day, and that still confronts it today, is the fact that the forces of production lag far behind the new socialist property relations. Now, as far as Marxists are concerned, on a global scale, this type of contradiction between productive forces and property forms is upside down. This is not the real problem that faces mankind. As Marxists, we hold that the crisis of capitalism on a world scale flows from the fact that the forces of production have outstripped the capitalist property relations, the other way around. Now, this is the main contradiction in the world today. It's the essential contradiction. It's the primary kind of contradiction, that the property forms have become fetters on the further development of the productive forces. The forces of production have outgrown the capitalist proper relations and the national boundaries as well. And as I said, this is the decisive contradiction in the world today. It is this contradiction that brings the socialist world revolution into being in backward countries as well as in more developed countries. Now, the socialist world revolution will eventually sweep away this basic and decisive contradiction between the property forms and the productive forces. But in the meantime, the world revolution has its ebbs and flows. It has suffered interruptions as well as its continuity. Entirely progressive and revolutionary property forms have become isolated for a time in the most impoverished sections of the world, resulting in this upside-down, inside-out absurdity. This abnormality, this temporary contradiction of the productive forces not being ahead of the property forms, but lagging way behind, which of course, as I said, is the inverse of what's wrong with the world today. But this absurdity cannot be avoided as long as the socialist world revolution is confined to the economically backward parts of the world. It is this secondary and derivative type of contradiction that has given rise to all sorts of bastardized and abortive social formations, resulting in degenerated and deformed worker states in the underdeveloped parts of the world. Now, these bureaucratic formations that have sprung up in these economically retarded worker states are nothing but the rebirth of potentially bourgeois and actually petty bourgeois tendencies. And nowhere are conditions for the growth of such tendencies more propitious than in the soil of China. The anti-socialist consequences of this absurd contradiction can be mitigated by correct economic and political policies. But the absurdity that I refer to cannot be removed except by the worldwide victory of socialism. And this, of course, means the victory of the working class in the economically advanced countries. Of course, given enough time, assuming the defeat of both the capitalist restorationist moves inside the country, as well as the interventionist moves from outside the country, given also the successful resistance to the corrosive effects of the world capitalist economy on such an isolated economy of a worker state in an underdeveloped country, the gap can be closed a little bit, and the contradiction perhaps eventually removed. But this is not a realistic perspective, it's a utopian perspective, and it's a perspective held primarily by the Soviet bureaucracy. Now, despite the enormous industrial gains of the Soviet Union, however, the relationship of forces between capitalism and worker states in economically backward countries to this day is still much too unfavorable for the latter to prevail over capitalism without the intervention of the working class in the principal capitalist lands. Now, it was the enormous merit of the Lenin-Trotsky regime in the Soviet Union that they understood this. From 1917 to 1922, they sought out all the possibilities for accelerating social transformations in Russia, but they knew their limitations because of their isolation in a backward country. And this, of course, this two-sided approach, seeking out what is possible but realizing the limitations of what is possible, flowed from their perspectives of world revolution. And this is the kind of perspective, an internationalist revolutionary outlook, that allows a worker state regime to pursue a correct policy both at home and abroad, and this is what the Mao regime lacks. The Mao regime seeks out neither the real possibilities and tries to take full advantage of them. They know not how to do this. Nor do they make allowances for limitations and difficulties because they are in a backward and isolated country. Instead, Maoism whips its followers into a red-hot frenzy, where tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of Red Guards roam the street and presumably accomplish by sheer willpower something that cannot be helped without outside aid, without socialist revolutions in the advanced countries of the world. Now, I said that the primary tendency towards bureaucracy in China is due to the poverty of the country and the impossibility as yet of linking up with an economically advanced center, such as Japan, which is the closest at hand, or Western Europe or the United States, until socialist revolutions occur there. But this primary tendency towards bureaucratism in China has been reinforced by the fact that the Maoist group lacks a Leninist, Trotskyist appreciation of this primary tendency and its dangers. They even go so far as to incarnate Stalin, who is the very incarnation of bureaucratism, as part of their official state religion, and I don't know what else you can call it. I don't know if you have seen the pictures of the processions. They call them demonstrations. I would call them processions of Red Guards, each carrying a selected volume of Mao's works, all open to the same page with Mao's pictures. And at the head of the procession is like an altar with Mao's picture. And if that isn't the same thing as a Catholic procession, I've never seen it. Even the same page, you're like carrying a Bible with Mao Zedong's infallible thought. I don't know if you've been following the press, but let me just give you some of the things that have been going on. The official liturgy, as it is. The official People's Daily says, Chairman Mao is the red sun in our hearts. It is the sun that shines for the growth of all vegetables and the supreme instruction. You're missing the best part. There's more. He's also the supreme instruction in all work. Through study of the works of Mao Zedong, you can prevent drowning, cure burns, produce petroleum, reap bumper harvests despite drought, and somehow, with Mao Zedong's thinking, chicken feathers can certainly ascend to heaven, and many have already done so. I'm just reading this. Scientists are told to throw away their Russian and other foreign textbooks and find solution to their problems, such as making cathode ray tubes, for instance, in Mao Zedong's dialectical writings. All Western learning is denounced as politically dangerous. United States imperialism and all reactionaries are called paper tigers, which is one of Mao Zedong's famous sayings. And this is repeated endlessly. And the more United States imperialists intervene in Vietnam, and the stronger the intervention, and the more bombs rain down, the more this liturgy is repeated, that the imperialists are just paper tigers, the stronger they turn out to be. The east wind shall prevail over the west wind is another one of these winged sayings of Mao Zedong. And it too, it's repeated like a prayer. And the worse things get, and the less likely this looks, the more it is repeated by more people and the more loudly, with gongs and brass drums and whatnot. Now, faced with these paeans of praise heaped upon Mao Zedong's thought, since we happen to know a little history, let's recall a few thoughts, or a few facts, rather, about the history of the Third Chinese Revolution and Mao Zedong's thought. Because the historical truth is that, to start with, Mao Zedong's thought started out as a carbon copy of Stalin's thought in Moscow. And he faithfully followed the Moscow line of class collaboration in Stalin's day. During the war against the Japanese, for instance, when Chiang Kai-shek happened to be arrested by the Xi'an garrison, who liberated Chiang Kai-shek and set him free? Mao Zedong, that's who. At the height of the mass movement against the Japanese invasion, the Maoists disbanded their so-called Soviets, dissolved their Red Army, abandoned land reform, and brief, subordinated everything to class collaboration with Chiang Kai-shek. And the Maoists pursued this line of class collaboration with the Kuomintang and Chiang Kai-shek from 1936 to 1947. Following the Japanese surrender, the United States government, with Stalin's agreement at Yalta and elsewhere, sought to impose the old Kuomintang order. And a new upsurge of the Chinese masses followed, part of the general post-war revolutionary upsurge. But the Chinese Maoists, exactly like the Stalinists in Western Europe, resisted this pressure of the workers, peasants, and students who rallied under their banner for a showdown against the existing order. But unlike the European capitalists, who to save their rule welcomed the Stalinists into their coalition cabinets, Chiang Kai-shek repulsed Mao's advances for a coalition government. Instead, Chiang Kai-shek opened an unsuccessful war of annihilation against Mao and company and his troops. It wasn't that Mao Zedong's thought was invincible or his policy correct, but that the Chinese bourgeoisie under Chiang Kai-shek was so feeble that they were afraid of a coalition government, so that state power fell into Mao's hands without his volition. That's the truth of the history. Throughout the Third Chinese Revolution, Mao and company imposed arbitrary restrictions and limits upon its course. The agrarian reform was carried out in stages, and it was completed only when American imperialism stimulated the opposition of the landlords during the Korean War. And by imposing these arbitrary restraints on the revolution, Mao and company safeguarded their bureaucratic control over the revolution. Mao's objective at all times was to restrict the struggle as much as possible to the military plane. And it was in this way that he could prevent the Chinese workers from emerging on the arena as an independent force. From the very beginning, the Third Chinese Revolution was deformed by the Maoist leadership and control. And in turn, this deformation of the revolution rendered its development more costly, convulsive, and protracted. What prevailed in China was not Mao Zedong's thought, which was the line of coalition with Chiang Kai-shek, but what prevailed was the struggle against Chiang Kai-shek, and not the solution of democratic tasks hand in hand with Chiang Kai-shek, which was Mao Zedong's thought, but class struggle methods, even though deformed against Chiang, against the landlords, against the bureaucratic capitalists, and against the imperialists. Now, it's true that the achievements of the Chinese Revolution, as those of the Russian Revolution, are prodigious, even under bureaucratic leadership. But the ability of this bureaucratic leadership to retard the struggle and to bring victory into question again and again and again, this is something we must not lose sight of, especially at this point. Because to this day, the Chinese Communist Party is not based on the working class and does not seek to chart its way by Leninist theory, despite its protestations. The party is bureaucratized. The cadres form an economically privileged and privilege-seeking layer. And they are trained ideologically in Maoism as well as Stalinism. And if you want to define that, that's a brand of empiricism given to the use of Marxist phrases. The party leadership does not foresee trends. It does not shape its policies accordingly. It tends instead to swing violently from one course to another in reaction to events without thinking about the ultimate consequences, either of the swings or of the course in which they're engaged upon. In the Great Leap Forward, Mao set out to build communism in one country, in China, at a faster rate than either Stalin or Khrushchev ever dreamed of in the Soviet Union. The Great Leap Forward injured China's economy gravely. It had to be abandoned. It was followed by an economic retreat. And finally, they gave up the Stalinist emphasis on heavy industry. Now, this empirical zigzagging in economic planning shows, among other things, what I've talked about before, the inability of the Mao grouping to achieve some degree of foresight where they are going and what they're doing. Now, at the same time, while you're saying all this, it's true, the Maoist leadership was also shaped by the long years of difficult struggle, and it underwent the impact of a great popular revolution that brought it to power. That is also true. And therefore, it is true that the bureaucratism in China, bad as it is in and of itself, is not the same as the bureaucratism in the Soviet Union that has developed into such a powerful, consolidated caste inside the country. And the Maoist group itself, however fixed its bureaucratic pattern of thinking and practices, is not merely repeating the policies and views of Stalin. For instance, they display a number of differences with Stalin on a number of questions. Perhaps the key one is the one of building socialism in one country, where the Maoists instead advance the idea of uninterrupted revolution. And particularly since the disaster of the Great Leap Forward, the Chinese leaders have been emphasizing the need for socialism to triumph in other countries. Well, this break with Stalinist ideology in turn led to the Moscow-Peking dispute, where they advanced a number of progressive views. But it is a long way from an empty and ritualistic adulation of Mao Zedong's thought and the making of a revolution, or the advancement of revolutionary positions and the carrying out of that position in a country, as witness Indonesia, Vietnam, the Great Leap Forward, and the other things. Now, the extremely difficult situation in which the Mao leadership finds itself today, partially due to its own past and current mistakes, has led them now into this current extravaganza of this so-called proletarian cultural revolution. Mao's thought now is the greatest truth since time immemorial. The theory and practice of Comrade Mao Zedong may be likened to the ceaseless movement in the skies of the sun and the moon and the endless flow of the rivers and the streams on earth. Maybe good poetry, but I don't know if it says anything. Now, these panegyrics outstrip any homage that was paid to Stalin at the height of his despotism in the Soviet Union. And they may very well be appropriate to the worship of a Chinese or an Asiatic god emperor by superstitious subjects. But they are wholly out of place in a society permeated supposedly with socialist teachings and scientific attitudes. Now, while these incantations to Mao's thought are going on, that isn't the only thing that is happening. The ranks of the Chinese Communist Party are being purged from top to bottom and all the way along the middle ranks as well. Many of those affected along the top leadership are intellectuals who years ago voiced doubts about the wisdom of the Great Leap Forward of 1958. The presidents of the Peking University and many other leading institutions have been sacked, along with numerous professors, all under the slogan of the Great Cultural Revolution. Newspaper editors, writers, party chiefs on the local level also have been rectified, as the term is called. Some army units have become under suspicion as politically flabby, and the chief of staff is believed to have been purged. And all of this has led to speculation in the capitalist press about succession to the party leadership, and they advance Marshal Lin Pao, the army commander, who incidentally is the youngest man in the Politburo of the Communist Party, where the average age is 68, and Lin Pao is only 59. Now, Lin has long stressed the Maoist line that political consideration is supreme over all other considerations. Economic, anything else. Lin has purged the military of officers who favored acceptance of Soviet arms and conventional tactics over the simplified rifle and millet brand of guerrilla warfare, flavored with ideological training that is now being emphasized. Along the line of another one of Mao's saying that the force of the people is a spiritual atom bomb and you don't need anything else. Now, Lin's political platitudes are quoted to soldiers, workers, and peasants, and he is termed the leading exponent of Maoism. Now, according to the Chinese press, those are being that are being purged, and I'm quoting now, dreamt of creating in China a replica of the 1956 Hungarian incident to bring chaos to the country, so they might come out to save the situation, to take over the rule, and to restore capitalism in China, unquote. Well, I don't know. The reference to the Hungarian Revolution somewhat gives the game away, because that was not a counter-revolutionary uprising, but a revolutionary uprising against bureaucracy. But in any case, we know that ever since the Communist Manifesto of 1848, genuine revolutionary socialist movements have taken internationalism as their effective guide. And they have done so both in arriving at their policy and then in explaining and justifying these policies to the rest of the working class and the rest of the world. But Mao and his associates have been flouting this principle of international class solidarity. They have disregarded any supporters of the Chinese Revolution throughout the world who are confused by this enforced ignorance of the issues around the internal struggle that is agitating China today. Because the issue cannot be that a group of intellectuals were plotting a counter-revolutionary capitalist restoration, all of them communist intellectuals on the highest ranks in the party. It's not the nature of the intellectuals to plant those kind of coups. The military, perhaps, but not the intellectuals. Well, let me just give you a few quotes, which you get secondhand, about what these intellectuals said. Now, this you get secondhand as they're being denounced for their wrong views. You do get a few intimations of what they might have been thinking. But again, you don't get it firsthand from them, but only secondhand as they're being denounced. Teng To, for instance, who's supposed to be the leader of this supposed anti-party, anti-socialist gang of conspirators, demons, and monsters, he committed the unpardonable crime of questioning Mao's infallibility. For instance, in parables, mind you, in parables, biblically again, which have just been produced in being denounced, Tang said, "It is only a wild dream of foolish men to know everything and to possess inexhaustible wisdom." In another article, Tang said, in referring to a famous reforming prime minister in Chinese history, Wang Anshi, who had many new ideas but one great shortcoming, quote, he was not open-minded, unquote. And that is being held against him. Now, from the Peking Review, there are other snatches of the views of the oppositionists, and I want to read them to you, just so, again, you know, this is secondhand, but you get an idea of what the oppositionists were thinking. The theory of truthful writing was advocated by the revisionists. The counter-revolutionary Hu Feng was an exponent of it, and so was Feng Xian Feng. They advocated truthful writing in order to seek out the seamy side, in quotes, of life in socialist society and the rotten things left over from history so as to paint our splendid socialist society in dark colors. Proletarian writers must consider what subject matter is of value to the people before they start writing. And a specific subject should be selected and written up in order to foster proletarian ideology and liquidate bourgeois ideology and encourage the masses to be firm in taking the socialist road. These writers argued that too many of our films dealt with the revolution and armed struggle, that unless a break was made, no really new films could be produced. Other advocates of this theory were in favor of writing books with human interest, in quotes, love of mankind, in quotes, insignificant people, quotes, and minor events. Well, not in China today. The aim of these proposals was actually to lead literature and art astray from the path of serving proletarian politics. The chief exponent of the so-called theory of middle characters was Shao Chanlin. He slandered the vast majority of our poor and lower middle class peasants as people in an intermediate state vacillating between socialism and capitalism, which has been the traditional Marxist view. In recent years, there were also some people in China who repeatedly clamored that our writing reeked of gunpowder and our stage bristled with guns, and that this was not artistic. They wanted writers to discard the classics of revolution and rebel against the orthodoxy of war. This theory was in essence a reflection of the revisionist trend in our literary and art circles. Well, these are the people that are accused of plotting a counter-revolution, and all they want is a little freedom to select their own subject matter and not to have the endless march, long march, always on the stage with the people with rifles fighting the landlords and the imperialists and so on. Now, there are some reports that a fierce dispute is in progress over agrarian policy. And the dissidents have suggested that peasants be allowed to sell in the open market the produce grown in their tiny private plots. But the Mao grouping apparently plans to introduce some unpopular measures in the next 2 months involving the socialization of the peasants' small private individual plots. But as yet, we do not know that for sure. But whatever may be contemplated in the rural economy, one thing is clear, that in these repressive measures against the intellectuals, in these Red Guard sweeps through the city streets, that these are the regime's reply to the desire for more freedom of thought and expression among the intellectuals, as well as among other layers in the population. Now, in the first place, if the Chinese Communist Party operated along Leninist lines, its own members, as well as the rest of the world, would be informed about the contending views and arguments, so they would be able to discuss, criticize, and as far as the Chinese Communist Party is concerned, decide upon them. In this way, there would be democracy and the control of the ranks over the leaders, but there are no signs of this. Now, one of the critical tests of the solidity of mass support for any party that is in power is its ability to conduct open self-criticism. If that party in power is not afraid of its constituents, it can afford to admit its mistakes. It can explain what errors produced untenable positions and suggest how a new course can be taken. But if this ruling party no longer has the confidence of the masses, it builds up a web of mystification about its own past and seeks to show that every new course of action was really long foreseen and this is just the same course that was followed previously. Thus, the party has never made a mistake. It has nothing to explain and nothing to discuss. And not only that, it never will make a mistake. Even as the party veers from one course to the other, 180-degree turns, the leaders announce that there has been no change because they're afraid of their constituents, of their mass support. That is the explanation. And the Maoists have become masters at this cultism and mystification. All university and secondary schools have been suspended for 6 months so that youths can all participate in the Red Guard campaigns. Now, the teenagers might like such an interruption of the educational process, but in a backward socialist country, Such an interruption of training is injurious to the nation on the face of it. And besides, what has the youth Red Guard been doing? Well, they've carried this Maoist method of non-debate to the country at large, not just inside the Chinese Communist Party, where there never has been any debate, but this Maoist procedure of denunciation, they have now taken this to the population at large. Now, in the Peking Review of August 12th, are the 16 points of the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party concerning the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution adopted August 8th. This is supposedly the point under which the Red Guard is functioning. Let me just quote you a little bit so you get the idea. At present, our objective is to struggle against and crush those persons in authority who are taking the capitalist road, to criticize and repudiate the reactionary bourgeois academic authorities and the ideology of the bourgeoisie and all other exploiting classes, and to transform education, literature, and art and all other parts of the superstructure that do not correspond to the socialist economic base so as to facilitate the consolidation and development of the socialist system. Well, that's pretty far-reaching. They're going to purge the state apparatus from capitalist authorities, but the state apparatus is all held by Communist Party members, you must remember. So then there is another article here, number 7. It says, be on guard against those who brand the revolutionary masses as counter-revolutionaries. And then it says, in certain schools, units, and work teams of the Cultural Revolution, some of the persons in charge have organized counterattacks against the masses who put up big character posters against them. These people have even advanced such slogans as, opposition to the leaders of a unit or a work team means opposition to the party's central committee, means opposition to the party and socialism, means counter-revolution. In this way, it is inevitable that their blows will fall on some really revolutionary activists. This is an error on matters of orientation, etc. And it is necessary to beware of such pickpockets and expose their tricks in good time. In other words, there are some Communist Party members who are part of the state apparatus who are fighting back, calling the Red Guards counter-revolutionaries. Well, that's something to think about what's going on. Now, there's also another paragraph on the correct handling of contradictions among the people. And it says, the method to be used in debates is to present the facts, reason things out, and persuade through reasoning. Any method of forcing a minority holding a different view to submit is impermissible. The minority should be protected because sometimes the truth is with the minority. Hear, hear. Even if the minority is wrong, they should still be allowed to argue their case and reserve their views. Well, those are good words, but what has the Red Guard been doing? And here I must quote from Newsweek now of September 5th. That's the latest issue. Well, they state, bands of Red Guards were roaming through Peking as though they were its masters. Their target was anything and everything that smacked of comfort, sophistication, foreign influence, or traditional Chinese culture. Implacably, they forced so-called corrupted teenagers with long hair and tight trousers to shear their locks and rip their pants up the seams. Women were driven home to wash curls out of their hair, scrub off lipstick, and other makeup and slip out of dresses in the baggy pantaloons and cotton blouses favored by the guardsmen. Hairdressers had hastily put up signs pledging to give only the approved short haircut, while communal bathhouses stopped offering massages, pedicures, and manicures. Tailor shops offered rapid alterations for Western-style clothes, while one terrorized government-owned department store whipped cosmetics off its counters and replaced them with hundreds of cakes of soap. And that was only the beginning. Emboldened by newspaper editorials proclaiming that everyone must learn from the Red Guard, the youngsters next began breaking into private homes, removing Western items and forcing bourgeois Chinese to parade through the streets covered with flour to emphasize the fact that they were not red enough. Other victims were herded along wearing placards reading, "I oppose the revolution," and some were beaten. Flowers were branded as anti-revolutionary. Pedicabs, too, came under attack. A Red Guard poster at one pedicab stand, "They were still for hire, but the passenger should pedal himself while the driver rode in the seat." The guardsmen demanded that stoplights be altered because it is inconceivable that red should signify halt in the proletarian land. Before long, even Peking's foreign colony came under attack. Apartment buildings housing foreign residents were invaded by shouting youths who plastered portraits of Mao on every door. Well, so forth and so on. But apparently the Red Guard exceeded its instructions, as we saw. This seems to go far beyond methods of persuasion and reasoning and no violence and so forth. So a big meeting was called this Wednesday, where hundreds of thousands of Chinese Red Guard appeared on the main square. And this is what the Los Angeles Times of September 1st reports. "The young revolutionaries who have held sway over much of the city for 10 days were ordered Wednesday to stick to peaceful persuasion in their anti-bourgeois campaign and to remember that supreme authority lies with the Communist Party's Central Committee. The guard was told in a printed directive signed by a Red Guard Control Committee and posted throughout the city that they have made some mistakes in applying China's proletarian cultural revolution. It said some revolutionary families were attacked in the drive to uproot everything bourgeois and Western. Another poster told the Red Guard it is not allowed to inspect the homes of party functionaries and army commanders. It also said they had to get permission from the police, the local street communist association, and the local Red Guard center before inspecting a private house. The poster added that all property taken from houses by the Red Guard belongs to the state and should be handed over to special depots. The directive told the Red Guard it should not search official homes and risk revealing state secrets, nor should it take government cars. And it also told them to respect foreigners and not to stop military or foreign vehicles." And so forth. Well, you know, talking about a revolution when you have to get permission from the police to carry it out, it seems some phony kind of revolution, to be sure. Now, if the Mao regime were really democratic in outlook, it would do what Castro has done so many times in Cuba, what Lenin and Trotsky did in the Soviet Union on similar occasions when the revolution confronted difficulties and dangers. That is, they would come before the nation and before the country and before the world at large, and they would state what the problems are. And not only that, that there were different points of view on how to cope with the problems. And then they would show what decision they had made and why they didn't make a different decision. But instead of all this, the Maoists are intensifying their idealist, sectarian, and bureaucratic policies, strengthening the bureaucratic character of the Chinese worker state, and deepening the cult of the personality of Mao. Now, let me just say a word about the proletarian culture and proletarian cultural revolution under which all this takes place, presumably. This slogan of proletarian culture was a false slogan and was rejected as such by Lenin in the early days of the Soviet Republic. It's true that every ruling class creates its own culture and its own art. For instance, history has known the slave-owning cultures of the East and of classic antiquity, and they had their art and their culture. There was the feudal culture of medieval Europe and the bourgeois culture that now rules the world. And it would seem logical from this that the proletariat, which is the next power to come into state power, that the proletariat must also create its own art and its own culture when it establishes a worker state. But the question is not that simple. For instance, the societies in which the slave owners were the ruling class existed for many thousands of years, or at least for centuries, and enabled them to establish a culture which it takes a long time to establish. The same is true of feudalism and bourgeois culture, the most recent one. If we only count from the period of Renaissance, how long did it take the bourgeoisie to establish a bourgeois culture? Well, a high point of bourgeois culture I would put in the last half of the 19th century. Well, it took them about 450 years to establish a bourgeois culture, did it not? In other words, it takes considerable time, and it reaches completion only in the period preceding the political and economic decadence of that ruling class. But the proletariat acquires ruling power exactly for the purpose of doing away with class society to make way for a truly human, that is, a socialist culture. But this establishment of a culture takes centuries, epochs, historical eras, as did all the other cultures, and the proletariat simply doesn't have enough time for that. As a matter of fact, in backward countries, and even in more advanced ones, it would be true also, but in China or in Cuba or in the Soviet Union, capitalism was done away with before the working people had appropriated even the fundamentals of bourgeois culture. And as a matter of fact, the working class was forced to do away with capitalist society precisely because society did not allow them to appropriate bourgeois culture. So after the revolution, the proletariat and the revolutionary masses faced the task of assimilating the achievements of bourgeois culture, not its decadent parts, but its positive accomplishments. But this is not done by ridiculing bourgeois science and art, or by trying to stamp it out, as the Red Guard is attempting to do. As a matter of fact, what goes on under the name of the Great Proletarian Revolution in China seems to be, at this stage, under the Red Guard campaign at least, much more of a case of xenophobia and a cult of ignorance than anything else, and certainly not the acquisition of culture. For instance, let me read again from another newspaper, the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, September 1st. A druggist in Nanchang was forced to rename his shop Down with the Bourgeoisie Drugstore. In Shenyang, happiness was decreed a capitalist sin. A candy store was ordered to drop happiness from its name because, said the Red Guards, we will not let them continue to pour out such poison. To bookstores, they said, do not sell or lend yellow books and magazines. So the bookstores were raided, and the stores threw out all their books and substituted Mao's works. Art stores threw out all their classical paintings and substituted only portraits of Mao. Red Guards placed a ban on the sale of sunglasses, too bourgeois. Chess has become taboo. It's a Russian game, you know. Although it isn't. Oh, the Russians play it anyway. Former capitalists must be reformed. Ancient men and women trudge through city streets bearing signs proclaiming themselves opponents of the revolution while the teenagers jeer. Bus drivers were told, hang pictures of Mao in the buses within 2 days or face the consequences. Everywhere old names were changed. Peking Union Hospital became anti-imperialist hospital. The Kailan coal mines in Hopei province became the anti-imperialist coal mines. Shanghai's Eternal Tranquility department store now is the Eternal Struggle department store. We have a few of those here too, don't we? Traffic lights will be confusing. Since red is the revolutionary color, traffic will now move forward on red and stop on green. Remember that when you get to China, will you? Before long, what is known now as the Moscow-Peking split may be called the Moscow-Tung-Fang-Hung split. The youngsters are demanding that Peking's name be changed to the East is Red. Well, all of this parades under the name of the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution. But the building of a new culture rests upon the basis of the old culture, and not upon starting completely afresh. Now, if the Maoists actually meant by the Proletarian Cultural Revolution, say, the general adoption of a Latin alphabet for the Chinese language, the achievement of 100% literacy by 700 million Chinese, one could even conceive, by stretching things a little, of calling this a proletarian cultural revolution. But they're not doing this. They're substituting Mao's thought for science and for learning, and Mao's portrait for art. Now, there can be no doubt that after every great revolution, there is a great thirst by the revolutionary people for culture, for acquiring all the things that were denied to them before. But the salt water of Mao's infallible thought and the sight of his portrait everywhere is not going to slake the thirst for culture and for learning or for the achievements of the 20th century by China's masses. Now, the ruling formations, the ruling bureaucratic formations of a worker state are sometimes compelled by their social position as rulers of a worker state to defend not only their own reactionary caste interests, but also to defend in their own reactionary way the acquisitions of the revolution. But is this what is happening here? Because Maoism is seeking to overcome the difficulties, the objective difficulties of the Chinese Revolution as it faces the increasing pressures of American imperialism by sheer willpower, without any regard to the realities and the limitations of the difficulties of the situation. And in the end, Mao's present policy can only weaken the Chinese worker state and strengthen the American imperialists. And this, incidentally, is the view of the American imperialists. For instance, there's an article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal, and it was headed, "After the Purge, China Experts Say Big Campaign May Backfire on Reds." And here's what they say. "Peking's fevered, almost spiritual approach seems increasingly metaphysical. It is almost as if ideology itself is expected to offset material shortages. The experts here cannot see how studying Mao's work can significantly raise steel output when there are not enough mills or boost grain production when there are not enough tractors. They expect that the Chinese, traditionally pragmatists, will see this too with alarming clarity when the thought of Mao Zedong fails to produce the advertised results, as they are sure it will. They believe that the heavy indoctrination will strengthen, not eliminate, the skepticism of the Chinese thinkers." This is still the Wall Street Journal. "A young scientist who recently fled from China agrees." And he's quoted, "We had to spend 3 afternoons a week discussing how Mao's thought helped us solve laboratory problems. It was easy. I think we were smarter than the party people and we could make up any stories without any trouble." But, you know, it still takes time off work, three afternoons a week. "According to Western sinologists and Chinese press reports, such cynicism is now widespread. Given this space and the widening gulf between reality and ideology, they consider it more than a marginal possibility that China will become more flexible, more reasonable to deal with when the old party leadership dies off, or perhaps much sooner. The newly proclaimed Great Leap Forward may help accelerate the timetable too. Analysts don't expect the leadership to repeat the errors of 1958. but they do expect a further whittling away at private incentives and more forced savings by workers and peasants to avoid excess consumption, among other things. In short, they expect China to make just those moves which will encourage more disenchantment with present policy. One China student here says the ruling elite is setting the stage for the most rapid demaoization you can imagine, unquote. Well, these are the sworn enemies of the Chinese Revolution. They do not say these things lightly, you may be sure. Now, in summary, let me just say this. A worker state bureaucracy in a backward country such as China can take attitudes that objectively favor the revolutionary struggle of the masses, and I'm referring now to some of the attitudes taken in the China-Sino-Soviet conflict. Such attitudes may objectively favor the revolutionary struggle. And wherever this happens, we must recognize it and take advantage of it and utilize it. But the limitations of this process are now becoming apparent also. Because the deeply conservative interests of a bureaucracy as a social layer bar it from really accepting revolutionary Marxism, from really engaging in the field of revolutionary struggle, and thus of really making a revolution. And this is shown in a rather spectacular and negative way by what is going on in China today, because of the reverses that they suffered in Indonesia, Vietnam, and elsewhere. So consequently, we should not entertain any illusions about the possibility of any bureaucratic leadership, whether the old Soviet bureaucracy or the Chinese or any other worker state bureaucracy. No illusion about such a leadership being able to carry out the fundamental historic tasks of either constructing a genuine socialist democracy in the worker states or of crossing over from colonial revolutions into socialist revolution or from overthrowing capitalism in the industrially advanced capitalist countries. And this, again, this is the main contradiction. This is the main road and the only road that offers humanity escape from the present world system as well as from the threatening nuclear holocaust. If anything, the events in China today should make it clear to us that only a really revolutionary leadership allied only with the international working class can translate the revolutionary program of Marxism into reality.
Okay, first I'd like to make an announcement. Will all those who are waiting on tables please come into the kitchen for a conference at 5:30. That includes Kathy, Andrea, Andre, Ethel, Sue K, Sue P, Bitsy, Debbie, Jamie, and others. This is just a partial list.
I'll make one. I said before, and I want to repeat for those who are parents of small children, there will be a special event for children starting at 6 o'clock and bring the children right out here on the lawn. And Bill, is Bill here? Bill, will you stand up? Bill's going to be in charge with a couple of other people, and it will include dinner. It will include dinner. Dinner will be provided too. And all the children deliver out here, and they don't bring them into the dining room. We have a big enough problem as it is. They'll be well taken care of by experts.
Okay, we'll have questions now. There'll now be questions. For all those who wish to ask questions, would you please sort of start lining up over here and speak into the microphone so that we can record your questions and they won't have to be repeated. Are there any questions? Would you like, you want to come up here?
Well, first of all, on the question of cultism, I think Ted raised a lot of examples that are very good. One that I don't know if a lot of people are familiar with, but a few months ago, the Chinese won the world championship in table tennis in Japan. And the coach of the table tennis team, the Chinese table tennis team, wrote a news release for Xinhua, the Chinese news daily. And in it, he praised the study of Mao Zedong's thought as it relates to a victory in table tennis. Well, this whole development, I think, is very significant in conjunction with the criticism of the Chinese of the Soviet bureaucracy and the Soviet government. And I would like to ask Mr. Edwards to comment if he thinks that the Chinese party, through a development of this criticism, but at the same time being, you know, very under a great deal of pressure from this cultism, if the Chinese Communist Party has any possibility of developing within itself or through the forms of the Chinese Communist Party any types of revolutionary thought.
Well, I think the extent of the purge and the bureaucratically controlled mobilization of non-party youth against the party, which is what the Red Guard is, should indicate to us that the oppositionist currents in the Chinese Communist Party were very widespread. I don't know what else would explain this mobilization of the Red Guard, which is directed against the Communist Party. Don't forget that. That's what it is directed against. They talk, of course, again, they try to muddle things up. They throw in aged landlords and capitalists into it. But the main brunt of the attack of the Red Guard, as I understand it from the press reports and as I understand it from those 16 points of the Central Committee, is against the Communist Party itself. This is a tremendous purge of the Communist Party of China that is going on. Obviously, whoever is being purged might have been an oppositionist or wasn't considered reliable or didn't sing the praises of the cult, you know, convincingly enough or something. I don't know, my mind isn't made up yet whether Lin Pao is trying to do away with the Communist Party altogether in the course of this. That remains to be seen, and establish some kind of military dictatorship, I don't know. But it would bear watching what happens, how far the purge goes, and so forth, because the Red Guard and the permanent committees of the Cultural Revolutions are non-party instruments and apparently staffed by non-party people, and they're supposed to be permanent committees. So let's see now what happens to the rest of the state apparatus while all this goes on. But I would answer your question, yes, there's no doubt about it. There's widespread opposition. And as the Wall Street Journal says, this kind of thing can only backfire because it's patently absurd. You don't resolve that basic contradiction by an exertion of will and prayer-like incantations to the infallibility of anybody's thought, much less Mao Zedong's thought.
Yes, I'd like to ask Mr. Edwards, how would you reconcile the, at one hand, revolutionary policy, or apparently revolutionary policy of the Chinese Communist Party with regard to Latin America and the National Liberation Front in South Vietnam, with, on the other hand, the counter-revolutionary policy that has been displayed in large parts of Asia, such as Burma, Ceylon, Indonesia, and Pakistan?
I think you're addressing the question to the wrong person. I don't know if I can answer that question, except along this line, that they're not consistent. I'm not sure that they're following a revolutionary policy in South Vietnam with the National Liberation Front.
You see, at a certain stage, you have to distinguish between their declaration and what they're doing. And what they're doing, and I have quotes of this too in the Peking Review, they're teaching the South Vietnamese National Liberation Front that Mao Zedong's thought is infallible and the imperialists are paper tigers. Now, if that's a revolutionary approach, I don't know, if I were a guerrilla in South Vietnam, that's the last thing I would think, that imperialism is a paper tiger. But they quote this. There's a reporter of the Peking Review that travels in South Vietnam, and he reports these outbursts of praise towards Mao Zedong. And he talked to a guerrilla that was standing on a mountain that the guerrillas were holding, and the Americans were bombing it so much that the whole mountain had been lowered 100 yards. And the guerrilla said, "This proves that the imperialists are paper tigers because the mountain still stands." Well, you know, yes and no. Maybe tomorrow the mountain will be gone and the gorillas, you know. It's true that the, as I indicated, in the Sino-Soviet dispute, the Mao regime took positions that were to the left of the Soviet bureaucracy. That is true, and you know, we support those stands, we're for them. But it is also true that they made unprincipled alliances with class collaborationist communist parties like in Indonesia and in Japan. So they're not consistent, you know, you have to grant that. They take a revolutionary position where it doesn't matter too much, probably, and where it's far away, and where it's too close to home, they fall down. But, you know, that's their contradiction. But I think that the basic lesson to learn, even when a bureaucrat makes revolutionary noises, doesn't mean he's a revolutionary. You should take advantage of the revolutionary positions that he takes, but, you know, don't expect him to carry them out, even if he wants to. He can't. He's organically incapable of carrying them out.
I have a dual-faceted question. That these examples are very interesting, but how can we relate them to what is going on within China itself? How does it, say, like astronomers, we can't go there to observe directly, but we have to use inference to determine what is the state of class struggle in China. I think two concepts come to mind. Would you imagine that there is a section of the peasantry, say, that is rebelling, that is moving in a direction towards primitive capitalist accumulation, and is posing a serious economic threat to the bureaucracy, as happened during with the kulaks in the Soviet Union? Or most likely, is this attack against Westernism an attack against the rising aspirations of the Chinese masses? We know that they've solved the problem of food distribution to a certain extent, that there's a reasonable well-being in food consumption. So I've been told. Now, would this mean that the class struggle is taking on a massive form against the bureaucracy? That the westernization simply means, the attack against westernization means that this struggle is intensifying because of the aspirations for a better life, which the Chinese would identify with such things as, say, cosmetics, Western-style goods.
Well, first on the question, what's going on in China, how do you know? Well, you know, a doctor can tell what's wrong with a person sometimes from a tiny bit of tissue that has been taken from the person and make an analysis without ever seeing the person. A Marxist can read a document and some news reports and can tell what's wrong with a society. Not always, but sometimes. Scientists can go on very little evidence sometimes and make a correct analysis. You don't have to go there and do a Gallup poll of all the peasants to find out what's going on. That's the bourgeois method. A Marxist method is different. I admit I don't know what is going on because they do keep us in the dark, but there's certain things that we do know that are going on. And they tell us this. The Mao regime isn't saying that the peasants are rising up and want to restore capitalism. They're saying the communist intellectuals are rising up and want to restore capitalism. And they want to say that the peasants want to restore capitalism. That's wrong. The peasants are revolutionary, the Maoists say, and the communist intellectuals are counter-revolutionary. That's what the Maoists say. What does that mean? It means the Maoists are basing themselves on the capitalist aspirations of the peasantry against the communist intellectuals. If any, you know, that's the logic of what they're saying, that you can't picture the seamier side of life. And I quoted that middle theory where some writer wanted to write that the middle peasants aren't such hot socialists, you know, they're individualists and so on. They rule that out. You can't write that. The peasants up and down the line are hot Maoist socialists. And it's only the intellectuals that write about the peasantry in that vein that are counter-revolutionaries. So if anything, the Mao regime is not fighting the aspirations of the peasantry, but utilizing their sentiments against the intellectuals. The Westernism, what's wrong with Westernism? I don't mean bombs and so on, but what about the comforts of an industrial civilization? You know, we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. We're not against industries and economic power and electric lights and hot water and soap and cosmetics, if you want, just because it's, you know, grew up under capitalism. We want to get rid of capitalism but keep its good things and throw out the bad ones. But they're throwing out everything. Books, records, art, and start afresh. But the tragic thing is they have nothing to start with. I had another quote, which I didn't have time to read, that describes a Shanghai workers' music festival. And it was an 800-voice cantata to the working class of Shanghai, which you're familiar with, the Stalinist heroic style. You know, 1,000 workers march on the stage and sing, "Hooray, we built the factories," and red flags wave and so forth. And they had a description of a ballet, how they're establishing proletarian culture in the ballet. What they mean is that people take the classical French ballet and they carry red flags as they jump around the stage, and that's proletarian culture. And their big innovation is that they're using some Chinese instruments in the orchestra. And that's proletarian art. Or their other proletarian art is they're all people with bayonets and rifles marching on the stage. There's no, you know, in the bourgeois character, no hero, heroine, nothing like that. It's just masses of people marching across the stage, fighting, bayonets, gunpowder, you know, that kind of thing. And endlessly like that, and apparently it gets pretty dreary, you know. Some of the intellectuals will like to talk about something else, but that's out. You got to talk about the big thing, which is all right. You know, I have nothing against people running around the stage with red flags. That's fine, but, you know, I don't think it's proletarian art. It's French ballet with red flags.
Are there any more questions?
Ed,
would you like to come up
here, please? I don't think it's proper to quote Newsweek and the Wall Street Journal for your analysis of what's happening in the Cultural Revolution in China and not mention the fact that there have been documents beginning in the 1940s on the question of proletarian literature and art. That the proper procedure, it would seem to me, would be to analyze and attack the documents, beginning with Mao Zedong's lectures at the at Yan'an. There are several theoretical works on both art and literature, on academic disciplines, and specifically on the Cultural Revolution. put out by the Chinese in English. And I believe that the proper procedure would be to show that the program advanced and the analysis advanced is not revolutionary. And so now, but so I disagree with so many things on this that I don't know what to say, but I would ask the question is, what is the significance of the bitterness meetings? What is the significance of the big character sign, Da Zibao, that hang up where anybody can criticize anyone? What is the significance of the fact that a purge of intellectuals mean that intellectuals have to go work with their hands? What is the significance of the fact that schools are in factories and in factories, that schools, many schools, are now having their own factories? What is the significance of the fact that factories now have their own schools so that workers become intellectuals and vice versa? What is the significance of the fact that intellectuals are sent out into the countryside to work with the peasantry? What is the significance of the fact that there's a militia? What have you to say about a secret police in China? Just to take a few things. Also, on the question of the reform of the Chinese written language, that is, it's effective, everybody agreed on it, but the Chinese written language is reformed. It is now possible to learn Chinese very easily. It is, in fact, true that the Romanized alphabet is used, and it also, from the beginning of the Chinese Communist movement, the major effort has always been to teach people to read, to the point where peasants learn one character a day when they walk that way down the line, and another character when they walk the other way, and were always proud as to how many characters they learned. That's just a statement. So that, basically, I want to repeat what I said this morning. The people who are doing the purging are the people who made this revolution. Whatever their inadequacies are, it is not the epigones or sons of the revolutionaries who are carrying out a purge. It is the people who, beginning in 1921, have been in this revolutionary movement, specifically the faction led by Mao Zedong, which took power beginning in 1935. They've been there the whole time. And I don't think that it's that the question of the cult, I have reservations myself, but there's certain questions about it. If it is true that the Chinese working class is backward, I wonder whether it would be easier to talk about the thought of Mao Zedong with dialectical materialism as objective truth. Which would be easier? And suppose you read dialectical materialism instead of the thought of Mao Zedong. See? And when the guys are walking down the street, excuse me, they didn't have pictures of Mao, they had the book. Now the fact of the matter is that they had the book. Okay, they had the picture open, but they had the book. Now it's the works of Mao Zedong that are being put into the hands of the people. Now there are many such signs as this, it seems to me, to show that one simply can't write off any inadequacies of the Chinese leadership without recognizing the possibility that they intend seem to, that there's a lot of evidence that shows that they intend to make a proletarian revolution, and that they, when they say imperialism is a paper tiger, they mean that imperialism will be defeated and socialism will take its place. And it doesn't make a damn how many bombs drop if you can't do anything about it, see? And that the people will win. And at the same time, they build their own bomb. Don't forget that. So that basically, my honest feeling, I'm new to the party, I'm sorry I can't be more precise in the correct terminology, my comprehension isn't good enough, but my feeling is that an analysis of the Chinese leadership's policy internally in China, what they're trying to do in the transformation of that society, that takes the stand of siding with the petty bourgeois intellectuals in China is basically a bourgeois analysis rather than a proletarian analysis.
The quotes I had from the Newsweek and the Wall Street Journal were concerned with the events of the Red Guard campaign in the last few days. The other quotes I had were from the Peking Review, And that's an approved publication of the Mao regime. The debate in Marxist circles on proletarian cult goes back beyond the Yan'an forums. It goes back to the early days of the Soviet Union, where Trotsky wrote a book called Art and Literature. Literature and Revolution. So it's not a new discussion among Marxists about whether there is such a thing as proletarian culture. The point I was trying to make, that proletarian culture and the policy that is being followed by the Mao regime now was a policy that was rejected in the early days of the Soviet Union by the Soviet leaders there, and is a wrong approach to that question. As for the achievements of the Chinese Revolution, we do not belittle those. We're criticizing the regime and its policies. We support the revolution. We defend the worker state, but we criticize the deformations of a bureaucratic character of that state. And there's a difference. We speak as supporters of everything that is progressive that has taken place in China. But some of the things you quote are not progressive. Marxists have always held that socialism will overcome eventually the division between manual and intellectual labor. But that is a process. That is something like you can't abolish money or the state after you take revolution, after you take power. That's something that has to evolve as the economy increases and the productive forces increase. You can't decree that everybody be an intellectual or that every intellectual be a peasant in all parts, which is what Mao is doing again in that field. He decrees that every intellectual, that means doctors, engineers, physicians, etc., must work with their hands on the countryside for 6 months out of the year or something like that, which is just a tremendous waste of human labor. Because the peasant cannot go into the city and be a trained doctor and physician and engineer in a backward country which has a tremendous shortage of trained personnel. You know, pulling yourself up with your own bootstrap, but you don't get to socialism that way, you just disorient the economy. See, we speak as partisans and supporters, and we say what they're doing is wrong. Not because we're against the revolution, but because we're for it. What they're doing is weakening the revolution with that. They're not furthering the productive powers of China by forcing the intellectual to spend half their time in work to which they're not fitted. You know, intellectuals can't raise pigs. And I have quotes on that line too, where it's reported that the intellectuals raise pigs in their spare time, or not in their spare time, in half their time, and the pigs all die, and they try to have a vegetable garden, and nothing grows. And not only that, they send them out in work gangs to the farms, the collective farms, and they don't want them there because they don't know what to do in the fields either. You know, well, it sounds good. I'm for abolishing the division between intellectual and manual labor and for all men to be men of all parts, and women too. But this is not to be done by decree. You can't pass a law that says every intellectual will now be everything else and every peasant will now be an intellectual. It is not done by decree. You don't educate people by closing down the schools. The same thing with the schools and the factories. And what are they studying? Mao Zedong's words. You know, I don't know, he's not a bad dialectician, but you don't learn science and all the other skills by just studying dialectics. You also have to go into the concrete. Not only that, why throw out the Western scientific textbooks and not bother with them? Do the whole thing all yourself. You know, doesn't it sound nonsensical? I mean, doesn't it sound it would be better, you know, to go to the references, even though they are bourgeois references, and get the manpowers that the capitalists spent so you don't have to spend them? So that's all we're talking about. They're following a wasteful bureaucratic policy in their efforts to industrialize or increase the productive forces of China and to revolution. Now, you mention all the achievements of the revolution, and there's many more than you mentioned. There's more that I can mention. We're for the positive things. I didn't mention those. But I mentioned the shortcomings because we think there's a better policy, and we feel that we have the right to say so because we are supporters of that revolution. We might be the only supporters if this keeps up, you know. Because Mao Zedong and this kind of a policy doesn't make for a good impression. It really doesn't. It isn't just bourgeois distortions. It sounds harebrained. And it is. Not only that, it'll bounce back. You know, there'll be a big zigzag, a zag after the zig as you come back.
Actually, I was. There's no question that the period at the present time is developing is clearly a reactionary period, despite the attempts to call it a left development and elimination of certain trends. However, I certainly have disagreements with the kind of one-to-one relationship between certain ideas and clarion calls of the leadership and what's actually going on. For example, the idea that half the time is spent in the countryside, and so forth and so on. It would be absolutely impossible for this to have even taken place at any time during the Chinese Revolution, during the pot in the development. The Chinese Revolution and its economic growth has been faster and swifter than that of the Soviet Union. And if doctors were spending half the time in the countryside, they could not have made the great leaps, I'm even adopting the phraseology. They could not have made the strides forward that they did in, you know, eliminating, you know, the hazardous health conditions, so forth, increasing the number of hospitals, increasing the number of doctors that they have. It'd be a physical impossibility for anything like this to have taken place. Nonetheless, this kind of demagoguery of having the soldiers and having young guards, whatever they call Red Guards, come out in the streets, you know, this is a rightward swing. But I think, again, a mistake has been made by making a one-to-one relationship, by saying that they undoubtedly say that we are supporting the peasants against the intellectuals. What to me is more is likely is there should be some kind of analogy, examination to the third period in the Soviet Union, in which such a claim could be put forward without at the same time the leadership, you know, fearing what is actually a rightward development. In other words, I'm saying this one-to-one relationship, I do not think that because they're attacking these intellectuals in the city that they are in fact relying on some kind of new capitalist strata, that they are attempting to fight this capitalist strata in a bureaucratic way and in a demagogic way. And I think there are greater problems of analysis here than simply taking the texts as they have it and analyzing those texts formally and saying because they don't fit up with what should be a correct Marxist intellectual analysis of the of what is developing, that then going back and saying, well, this then is what happening. I think it's a very contradictory development that is happening, and I think what is happening might very well be a centrist formation attempting to use left-wing elements to hit against what might be a right-wing in China. But I don't think you can simply go and say that it is the right-wing moving against left-wing in China. I don't think that's at all what's happening. I think there's a lot of demagoguery and a lot of confusion going on, and certainly not the clarity that one saw in the political dispute within the Soviet Union.
Well, unfortunately, the timing of this speech is such that things are in flux, and it's very hard to make a definitive judgment. We simply have to go by the information that we have up to now. And at this point, it appears, as I stated in my speech, it would seem to be a move by the top Central Committee against the ranks and middle layers of the central of the Communist Party by mobilizing the Youth Red Guard. Now, it may turn out to be something else later on, as I would agree with that, not that we're reading the wrong documents or anything like that, but that the development isn't that clear as yet. I indicated another variant, that Lynn Powell might be trying to establish a military dictatorship and do away with the Communist Party of China. That is also a possibility, with Mao being incapacitated, but, you know, you're speculating. What is clear is that the intellectuals and the oppositional currents on the left that had grown up against Mao are being purged. That much is clear. That's what's happening. The rest will become clear later, but right now, that's what this development is aimed at, to stifle the left wing. That's on the face of it, by the what's happening, by the mechanics of it, that is what is occurring.
I just wanted to make a comment on this whole question of proletarian culture. Theodore Edwards took it up from one aspect. That's the aspect of the necessity of a worker state, of a proletarian revolution, attempting in its initial phase to assimilate all the achievements of world culture, bourgeois, and earlier cultures before that as its primary cultural task, rather than attempting initially to create a proletarian culture. Now, there's another aspect to that question, because it came up in the discussion where Ed made the comment that the appearance was, Ed DiTullio, that the appearance was that it was a struggle between the proletarian and the intellectual currents inside of the Chinese Revolution, because it was a defense of proletarian literature and proletarian culture against the intellectuals. But in this same discussion came up the first time that it was ever really posed for a worker state in the Soviet Union in the late teens and the early 20s, we had precisely the same phenomena. We had a grouping inside the party, grouped around the magazine Prolet Cult, proletarian culture, which was drafting all this kind of thing, this super proletarian, didactic kind of socialist realism that pictured society as it should be in a worker's state, and drafted for the proletariat its own literature and its own culture. And Trotsky and Lenin made a very sharp attack on this. They said this is not proletarian culture at all. The basic fact of the proletariat, or of any culture, is that culture is produced by a small, tiny minority within any given class. The bourgeoisie does not produce their culture. They allow a certain percentage of their surplus to support a certain number of their own class who devote themselves full-time to art, to literature, to science, and therefore assimilate the earlier culture and then create new culture. The proletariat as a class is deprived of that as a class, as a whole. As a whole, it hasn't reached the cultural level that the bourgeoisie, because of its class domination, is able to reach. Therefore, in the early stages of a proletarian revolution, what you have is intellectuals masquerading as proletarians and writing as though they were workers or as though they were peasants and creating an artificial culture. And that's essentially what all the proletarian cultures, so-called, that have come out of the Soviet Union or out of China are in their essential fundamentals. They are echelons of party intellectuals pretending to be workers, writing what workers should know, or should hear, or would write if they could write, which is not the way that that a revolution develops at all. Where the chief cultural task of a revolution in its writing is not to deal with the question of the long march, of the heroics of the revolution, even of the war against imperialism. is to deal with the concrete reality, the real problems that confront the revolution and the country itself, so that they can be understood, they can be grappled with, they can be dealt with. For that reason, you cannot have a didactic proletarian literature. It's sterile. And the other question I just want to deal with very shortly is this question of the Red Guards mobilized outside of the party. When any layer of the party goes outside of the party ranks, the party, in theory at least, is supposed to be the most conscious layer of the proletariat. Now, in China, this is very much in question as to what the exact composition of the party is. And it's at this point an open